be like a mash tent and a shower setup.
Great. So for this, what would your number one ask be for this camp that you would like to see that isn't here now and you feel is really needed?
Definitely showers and outhouses are definitely, yeah. Cleanliness and hygiene are most important, right? And yeah, this is something I gotta stress and I gotta agree with. I mean, the one thing we gotta do is clean up a little bit and yep. just make the place look better altogether. Yep. That's definitely my things that I wanna see with the campus. Get the mess cleaned up and then I'm gonna try to spearhead another cleanup again. Yep. The last month went really good and we got everything cleaned up and then just as quick as we get it cleaned up, it seems like it gets replaced, right?
It doesn't look too bad. It's pretty organized.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, we try to do that at least, right? But yeah, I wouldn't mind getting it a little bit better.
It's a pretty nice day today. We've just had one of those Arctic rivers or whatever they call it. Come through in the last few days. What's it like here when it's raining and when it's really raining?
Even in the summertime at nighttime, because it's coming off the water, it gets cold at night, right?
Yeah.
It's nice. It's nice during the day in the summer, and even like right now, it's really nice. Mm-hmm. But when it gets cold, it gets cold, right?
Yeah.
It's probably colder here than it is actually in the city.
Yeah.
When once the sun goes down, she gets a little bit chilly, but. I mean, the warming tent covers that, and you know, good blankets and good sleeping bags and whatnot, right? Insulated tarps, things like that.
What about the wetness when it rains? So does it drain pretty well, or do you get?
Everybody's kind of left on their own to figure out their drainage problems. Like we have guys that like myself, and we have three or four of us. Like I'm a trained automotive technician, and we got a couple guys that are trained in electrical and things like that. And so we try to help everybody. We try to come up with designs for everybody for like proper trenching and gravel and sand for drainage under the tents is what we like to see people do. Like ideally, what we try to get everybody to do is put some piles down with sand and then gravel and then a tarp on top of that so everything drains out. Because if you have the piles under your tent and it gets wet, they stay wet, right? So we try to get the drainage that way. As we're draining off, we have a little problem there. We're still working on getting some proper drainage flow. We're either trying to get it into the marsh or. We try to avoid getting anybody draining anything into the ocean, obviously, right?
Mm-hmm.
We try to drain everything towards the marsh, right? As long as it's not, like, you know, people's waste, right?
Yeah.
We also push that everybody has, I don't know if you know, so there's white water bins we have all around the camp that are, we call them white water and then gray water. Gray water is dirty water. If anybody's got any water that they use for hand washing or clothes washing or anything else, we take up the bathrooms and put down in the sewage.
Yeah.
Instead of, we totally are against anybody throwing anything into the ocean, right? Any dirty water. Anything like that. Basically, the drainage is a bit of an issue, but for the most part, it is what it is. I guess it's cold and it's not ideal for most people, but it's what we got right now, right?
Right.
And it's just a day to day thing. It's gotten a lot better since the start, right? What we started out with.
You've been here 4 years. Do you see yourself staying here?
I'm going to be here for a bit more. Yeah.
Yep.
I'm. Not unfortunately, but I mean fortunate, but yeah, unfortunately, I never really pictured my life taking this turn. But I guess this is maybe where I have to work for a while. Maybe there's a bit of a calling for me to help other people.
Right.
With the way I live my life, maybe I can do some good by helping some change in some ways, right? And it seems like that's the direction it's taken. So,
Do you mind talking about how you got here?
I moved to Vancouver when I was 12 years old when I first moved here. My family left me here. I was ended up on the streets homeless. That was in Richmond. I grew up there. I moved back to Calgary for a few years. Came back here again when my daughter turned 18 because basically the court took my daughter away because I was, you know, using drugs and was just on the street and homeless. I had no way having a kid when I was 17 anyway. But now once the court said I couldn't see her until I was 18 and. Or until she was 18, and when she turned 18, she wanted me to come back. So I always promised her that I would come back home as soon as if she called me. And so the day of her 18th birthday, I got a phone call, and I said to me, you want me to come back? And she said, yeah. So I was here 24 hours later, and I actually gave up drugs and quit cold turkey that same day. And it wasn't until a few years ago that I started using again. That's no excuse, but now my daughter lives in New Zealand.
Right.
But brought me here is just, like everybody's got a story, but it's just, yeah, it's a life of... You know, I didn't grow up in a family that had anything. It was, grew up poor and just, you know, it just goes on year after year, right? Like when you're raised in a family that doesn't have anything, it's hard to get anywhere, right? Or hard to see a way out. I mean, there are ways out, though, and it just takes a little bit of work, but it's just hard to see those avenues sometimes, right? And then, you know, mental problems are a bit of an issue, too, right? Like, a lot of us tend to have, you know, things like everything from seasonal affective disorder to bipolar, like, I have bipolar issues and things like that, so sometimes holding employment isn't, I try my best to work as much as I can, right?
Yep.
Like, I like to consider myself a working man, not a criminal, right? Like, I haven't been in any broad trouble with the law for almost 20 years now, so that's good. But, yeah, it's just, sometimes holding a job and getting to work constantly regular for me are a bit of a hassle and whatnot. An issue is just that my mental state is so up and down that that's what I end up in these situations. The last place I had, I ended up with an argument with the landlord just because I can't even remember what it was about. It was probably about some stupid issue I was having that you know, the neighbors in the fourplex didn't like me, and he ended up evicting me. Yeah, and it turns bad for me with a lot of my social interactions, so that's why I end up in places like this. Right. And everybody else has got their story, but that's mine, right? I've always had a problem interacting socially, and I guess what I mean, like it's, for me, this has been a benefit for me because I've learned how to start interacting with the public and socializing with people, so it's helped me greatly, actually, in that way.
Does this feel like home for you?
At the moment, yeah, it actually does. Maybe it is, right? Maybe some of us are just, you know, maybe this is what some of us don't need. Maybe some of us don't need a big white, you know, big house and a white picket fence and 2.5 kids and things like that, right?
Yep.
Some of us might may just not be made for that kind of life, right?
Like, yep.
And so, in some ways, yeah, it does. I mean, there's good and bad days, right? Like, today's a good one. Some are bad, right? Some are depressing.
Yep.
I mean, it's just, yeah. But for now, it does, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking to me today,
no
Clint.
No,
I really appreciate you taking
the
time. And, you know, I think it's an important that the larger community hears your voices.
Yeah, exactly.
Your own voices, not just, you know, everybody talking about you.
Yeah,
so thank
exactly.
you so much for taking the time today.
Yeah, that was cool. Yeah, no problem. Thank you. Yeah.
That was Clint Brandon, an interview I did with him just before Christmas. At the Crab Park Encampment, which is on the shores of Burrard Inlet, just adjacent to the Canada Place Pier and at the foot of Main Street. The Crab Park Encampment has become a bit of a fixture. It rose up or was created about 2.5 years ago when they shut down the very public homeless camp that had been set up at Strathcona Park in the Strathcona neighborhood of Vancouver. And when that camp shut down, a number of folks moved over to Crab Park because they weren't satisfied or comfortable with the housing being offered. The promise at the time was that everyone would be housed, but while there was always somewhere to go, it wasn't always a good place to go for a variety of reasons. So that was recorded right down on at Crab Park in early December. And I want to thank Fiona York for assisting in setting that up. And, of course, Clint Brandon for taking the time to talk to me. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. And both Ayu and Peter are here. Welcome, guys.
Hello, Magnus again.
Hello.
So we're you've got a review for us. You intended
I attended a music course by operatic.
Oh, junior. Nice.
Yeah.
Great. Well, tell us about it.
Okay. So last week, I attended a music concert at the Orpheum, and it was the debut performance by an indigenous operatic trio called the Divas, who collaborated with the Allegra Chamber Orchestra. And before the show, there was an indigenous market in the lobby, and I found so many beautiful items made by indigenous artisans, such as earrings, handmade icing cookies, scarves, and body mist. And I've been indigenous market several times before, and I always enjoy walking around and seeing the handmade items. It's amazing to feel the warmth of the artisans who create those items. And the show itself lasted about 2 hours, including an intermission. And it features opera and orchestral music composed by indigenous and Canadian artists. And three talented indigenous opera singers, Melody Courage, Rebecca Cuddy, and Michelle Lafferty, took the stage. The performance began with a strong woman song, which originated in the 1970s. And this powerful song represents solidarity, empowerment, strength, and survival. The singer's voice were very powerful and resonated with the beat of the indigenous drums. The drums added a deep intensity to the music, almost like the sound of a woman's footstep. As the performance progressed, the orchestra joined the singers and drums, creating a multi-layered and dramatic musical experience. The strong woman's song was played again toward the end of the concert, and its striking melody left a lasting impression. And each song had a background, and the singer explained it before the song if necessary. And also there was a screen in front of the hall showing English translation of the lyrics. I enjoyed all of the pieces, but my favorite was Storm Aria from Philomena by Joanne Estaccio. And it's actually based on the true story of a young Italian immigrant named Philomena in a remote corner of the Alberta Rockies. Philomena is forced into a loveless arranged marriage with a much older man, and at the wedding celebration, she steps outside for a moment, observing a storm brewing, gets lost in with its wonder. The way the orchestra and singers expressed the sound of the storm was amazing. I was surprised at the quality of the music, which captured the characteristics of the storm perfectly. For example, there were several fast-paced ascending and descending melodies that, along with sudden changes in volume, beautifully expressed the winds of the storm. Also, the strong attack and rapid decay of the final notes created an intense atmosphere, making me feel like I was experiencing the day of the storm. This was my first time experiencing indigenous music, and it gave me a new perspective on music. I believe that music is a powerful way to share the history and the culture of indigenous people and to convey meaningful messages to the audience. Especially this concert showed the strength of indigenous women. Okay, that's all for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Ayu. Tell us what the performance was again. And when was it?
So I attended a course by an indigenous opera directorial called the Indigidivas. Is it correct? Indigidivas, the name of the group, I guess.
Indigenous Divas.
Divas.
Divas. Indigenous Divas. There we go. Excellent. Well, thank you so much. And who is the accompanying orchestral group?
Yeah, the orchestra is Allegra Chamber Orchestra.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment with Peter. What are you going to talk about, Peter?
Cuba, why I'm not big on Castro, even though a lot of progressive people are, but I'm not, and I'm going to give you some reasons.
All right.
Not to like him.
We'll be right back after this.
You got to get
This is Bird Note. Any hobby or special interest has its own jargon. You'll pick up on the silly slang that birders use as you go, like calling the yellow-rumped warbler butterbutt. Still, learning a few basics of bird vocab is useful when you're starting out. It'll help you ask better questions when you're confused. And there's a good place to look for those vocab terms: the opening pages of a bird field guide. Most of the book is made up of species descriptions, but the first few sections have general info about what to call the different parts of a bird, basics on bird behavior, and birding tips. So it's a quick and helpful read before a trip to find birds. For now, here are a few vocab words to get you started. The feathers on top of a bird's head are called the crown. Bird vocalizations come in two general types: songs, used to attract mates, and calls, with other meanings such as alarm or just, "Hey, I'm over here." The bright white lines found on many songbirds' wings are called wing bars. Like any language, the more you immerse yourself, the faster you'll learn. For Bird Note, I'm Jonies Franklin.
And Peter, so, Fidel Castro.
No, I mentioned somebody yesterday was doing it. He said, oh, he liked it too. He liked Castro himself. No, Nelson Mandela was actually big on him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was in an emotional state. He went through quite a bit. Yep. And I am very respectful towards him. But I think that Castro bought his appreciation of that Nelson Mandela had of him. So I'm kind of disagreeing with him on this,
mm-hmm.
but I guess
I guess by buying you mean because the Cubans were supporters of the ANC when they were when they were the African National Congress before the end of apartheid.
So I think he Nelson Mandela was an intelligent person, but I don't agree with him on this. Mm-hmm. And I still respect him and his intelligence that he had.
Yep.
But one thing I found out was Pierre Trudeau,
mm-hmm.
before he became prime minister, he became prime minister in 1968 for a younger, he's the father of Justin. Of 1960, he rode a boat, a canoe, from Florida over to Cuba. And he actually went to Cuba in 1976. And actually, there was a bit of a problem with some people because Justin Trudeau went to the funeral of Castro and sort of said some good words. And that mm-hmm. was so.
Yeah, I remember. And then there was some backlash, from his comments about Castro when that happened.
So I am bucking a trend. I got some. I'm not going to go over. You're looking a bit scary at all these books. I'm not going to go over them. Is it that some of them? These were kind of random at the Burnaby Library, and a lot of them are just favorable. They don't really question it at all. Now I have here a graphic novel. Actually, this is really good. It's called Cuba, My Revolution. It's about it's a true story about a woman who was really big with the revolution and was very supportive of it and left Cuba in 1967, and it details how she found out that this wasn't the thing for her. And actually what happened in 1961, she was part of the some troops or whatever, maybe countering the Bay of Pigs. And what happened was that because she knew a person that went to Florida or something, that they had given her a medal that a dying soldier from the United States had given her. And because of that, they put her in jail. And her father, who was a medical doctor, had to get her out. And still it took her like three more years to figure, well, not so much figure out, but she was still very much felt the revolution was valid, even though she went through a pretty bad experience. But she was an artist, and when they had the art show that was sort of, because one of the things also that they were kind of against, like abstraction or modernism in Cuba. They wanted just a very, you have a picture of Fidel Castro and all this. And so it was during like an art show that she finally, because people write comments that were sort of critical, and then that gets her in part of the authorities, and then she just leaves because a lot of her family had left Cuba, and then she finally leaves it also. So that's a good one. Cuba by a revolution. So
would yours, because you said she believed in the revolution, but would you say that she was perhaps disillusioned?
Well,
or
no. Well, more than just disillusioned. I mean, she. She actually accepts this rather draconian thing that happened to her, being placed in jail in 1961 just because she had a locket from one of the soldiers had given it to her, the American ones, and she had a really bad experience in jail, experienced some health problems later on from what happened there, but still she sort of accepted what the revolution took a while. And so this is actually one of the few books in a way that does sort of chronicle, apart from like a reactionary in Florida, I guess, who is going to tell you how bad it is. Now, this is one book. I got a number of books. This is a book about Orwell in Cuba. So 1984. Oh, my goodness. Okay, I'm going to there's something really interesting in here.
So set up the book. Who's it by? And what's it largely about?
It's about how 1984 came to be finally published in Cuba.
Okay.
And in my amateurness, I didn't think to note what year it was finally published. But there was something else I was going to bring up. Okay. So Steven Spielberg came to Cuba for the Minority Report movie. Now, that idea of the Minority Report is that you're guilty before you make a crime. And what they note here is that Cuba has a kind of a law like that, actually. The law, in fact, authorized them to imprison as a preventive measure, any individual who might have a special promiscuity to commit a crime in that would, in a sense, manifest contradiction with socialist norms. So that's a law that Cuba has to this day.
So basically, if they think you might be, willing to act on something opposed to the revolution, you don't have to do it. If they just think you might be prone to that, they can detain you.
Yes. In fact, one of the reasons this is in the mid-60s, they have a friend of theirs who's a homosexual, the graphic novel I'm talking about, and he winds up being sent to a camp, and that sort of gets them. It's an overall process. The woman finally comes to a point that she doesn't like Cuba anymore. The other thing is that he blatantly lied. Castro, in 1959, he lied. Oops, it doesn't matter. He lied on the Ed Sullivan show that he was not a Marxist, and on Meet the Press also. So he blatantly lied. He always was. No, but he wasn't always the ringleader of them. Like, there was sort of a separate kind of Marxist approach. But he sort of won at the end. And he blatantly lied, and you can see it on YouTube on both of them. The other thing is that he sort of, in popular culture in the United States, Over the years, people have been sort of favorable towards him. Like,
yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, over the years, you know, Castro and the Cuban communist government always was sort of presented as somehow apart from what was going on in Europe and more closely under the you know, the Soviet control, and different from you know, governments in Vietnam or North Korea or any of the other sort of communist regimes. It definitely seemed to be regarded in much more positive terms and often quite uncritical terms.
Well, even like the Barbara Walters interview in 1977, and for our younger people, she died about a year or 2 years ago, Barbara Walters, but she had been retired. She did these very shallow kind of interview things, mm-hmm. and she was beyond four times a year, and she was on The View. She developed the idea of The View. But she, in 1977, went to Cuba, interviewed Castro. I saw a bit of like an update. She was talking about it. Like, what she was saying, so you have to remind yourself that she is a dictator. He is a dictator of a country and all this. But then it's always like, oh, he was so nice. He was very talkative and he did this. You know, it was like, on one hand, she sort of says, you have to remind yourself. The other sense, it was a wonderful time I had in Cuba, you know. And it's actually, there was one YouTube posting just had, like, people like Dan Rather and other people, that it sort of gets kind of a go, even, you know. It, in fact, they were aligned with the Soviets starting in 1960. And then that's what sort of got them in trouble in 1991, because the Soviet Union ended. Mm-hmm. But they didn't really have an economy, because they were paying more for their sugar cane than it was worth, really. And they didn't even have a basically one crop economy. They just were given amount by the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is that there's actually two embargoes. The first embargo was 1960. And that's when the Soviets sent them oil, petroleum. And the American, or actually it was the United States government, who did not want the American oil companies, who had their refineries there, to actually refine the oil. Now, but the second embargo is in the early part of 1962. And some people have argued, now, I'm really not for embargoes, because they hurt the people of the actual country.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the reason the second embargo happened, which was a larger embargo, was because American businesses were, you know, trying to do business with them, and Cuba just was not going to pay them. They were promising to pay,
right,
and they weren't. Now, so that's sort of the context of the second embargo, what happened.
So we got about a minute here. We've got a filled up time. Very fast. We might need to continue this next week.
Well, okay. Don't be suckered in by Castro. I mean, I said enough, I think, about this.
It definitely is an interesting story, though, because they did definitely do positive things like create a proper healthcare system and bring in social.
Oh, but okay, wait a minute. They're not. Their healthcare isn't. When you see the Michael Moore film Sicko, that's not their type of healthcare that they get.
Yeah,
it's very substandard to what you see in Michael Moore.
But I think what's often been overlooked is that they also had a lot of the mechanisms of dictatorship regime, like in the sense, you know, like being able to arrest people for merely stating their opposition or even indicating their opposition.
Or for being a homosexual, yeah. Not now, but that was decisively what their history is.
And I think over the years, you know, a lot of that side of the regime was sort of glossed over by supporters.
Well, he has a personality. Castro had a personality that even the American news media liked, the establishment media liked.
Charm. All right, well, we're out of time here. Thanks, Peter. And thanks to Ayu for her review of Indigenous Divas. And thanks to Fiona and Clint for at Crab Park.